In the South, segregation was pervasive but irrational. A department store like Woolworths would sell socks or toothpaste to blacks and whites indiscriminately, but then designate the lunch counter for whites only. On February the 1st, 1960, a group of black students in Greensboro, North Carolina, decided that they would eat where they chose. One of them was Franklin McCain, just 17 at the time. More than 40 years later, he recalled,
"We knew two things when we decided that we would go into Woolworth, sit down and ask for service at the lunch counter, which was taboo. At best, we were going to be hauled off to jail. The worst thing, of course, is that we would actually lose our lives by having our heads bursted open with a nightstick, or, God forbid, someone plugging us with a pistol. That was real. That was not imagined. It was just not a figure of speech. And I quickly went over my life for the past 17 years, saying to myself that if I'm ever going to do anything in this life, the time to do it is now. And there's probably no sacrifice that's too great to do what's just and right."
Lunch counter sit-ins soon spread across the whole South. Diane Nash was part of a more carefully planned protest in Nashville, Tennessee, a few weeks later. Time and again, the black students ordered food and were not served, but they sat tight on stools at the lunch counter. Young whites came to insult them, grinding out cigarette butts on their backs and pulling them off the stools. Yet the Nashville police targeted the blacks for disorderly conduct. According to Diane Nash,
"They said, everybody's under arrest. So we all got up and marched to the wagon. Then they turned and looked around at the lunch counter again, and the second wave of students had all taken their seats. Then a third wave. No matter what they did and how many they arrested, there was still a lunch counter full of students there."
Some of the sit-ins were spontaneous, but many of the students, black and white, had been trained in techniques of non-violent action based on the precepts of Gandhi. The students were from a different generation, impatient with the gradualism and compromises of their parents and of establishment black leaders like Martin Luther King. Although King is often thought of as the embodiment of the civil rights movement, the pace was really forced by thousands of courageous young activists. In 1961, it was the so-called Freedom Riders who hit the headlines. Travel between states was the preserve of federal law, and the Supreme Court had recently ruled that segregation on interstate buses and trains was unconstitutional. John Kennedy was now president, but though more liberal than Eisenhower, he wasn't keen to enforce the court's decision for fear of losing the support of racist Southern Democrats. So, said James Farmer, one of the Freedom Riders,
"What we had to do was make it more dangerous politically for the federal government not to enforce federal law than it would be to enforce federal law. We felt we could count on the racists of the South to create a crisis."
Specially trained pairs of volunteers would board an interstate bus. Whites sat in the back, where blacks were supposed to sit, and blacks at the front, refusing to move when ordered. At rest stops, blacks would go into the whites-only waiting rooms and try to use the facilities. Predictably, the volunteers were beaten up. Several buses were firebombed, and scores of riders were imprisoned and abused in the South's brutal jails. Eventually, the violence forced the president to act. From September 1961, interstate carriers and terminals were obliged to display signs stating that seating was without regard to race, colour, creed, or national origin. Emboldened by the successes of the young activists, in 1963, King and other black leaders targeted the city of Birmingham, Alabama, using marches and sit-ins to press for total desegregation of shops and facilities. Birmingham's police chief, Eugene Bull Connor, was an arrogant, blustering racist.
"The so-called Negro movement is a part of the attempted takeover of our country by the lazy, the indolent, the beatniks, the ignorant, and by some misguided religions and bleeding hearts."
Connor's vicious tactics played into King's hands. TV pictures flashed around the world showing children being blasted with water from fire hoses and chased by snarling police dogs.
Mr. Connor, would you care to explain why that was necessary in your view?
Because it was starting to rot. We don't want any rot.
Do you think you can keep Birmingham in the present situation of segregation?
I may not be able to do it, but I'll die trying.
Embarrassed and losing income every day, Birmingham's business leaders caved in and desegregated the city. King kept up the pressure with a march on Washington on August the 28th, 1963, attended by a quarter of a million people and televised around the world.
Damn, people are so close together, I can just see them still coming, row on row. It's a sight to behold, that's all I can say.
Let us break bread together on our knees.
The presence of thousands of whites, including folk singers like Joan Baez, who performed on that day, testified to the widening appeal of the civil rights movement. On the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, 100 years after his Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves, King voiced his own hope that one day America would honor its creed of freedom and justice. "I Have a Dream" was King's most resonant oration, but the impact made by his followers was equally important. That evening, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy returned to the Lincoln Memorial.
Where 250,000 people had sat that day, there was nothing but the wind blowing the leftover programs and scattering them across the way. And we were so proud of the fact that no violence had taken place that day. This was the greatest day of my life.
Aware of the changing public mood, President Kennedy proposed a new Civil Rights Act to Congress. But it was Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, who drove the legislation through on the back of Kennedy's assassination in November 1963. Yet Johnson, too, felt constrained by the Southern leadership in Congress. Once again, calculated and courageous black protesters forced the federal government to act. This time, they targeted the ballot box. In states like Mississippi and Alabama, the poorest and most racist in the Union, less than 10% of blacks of voting age were registered to vote. Registration in the US wasn't a case of simply returning a form in the mail. It was a public act, and in the Deep South, that act was made as difficult as possible. The registration office usually opened only a few days each month. Registrars tended to arrive late, leave early, and have long lunch breaks. So blacks had to take time off work to register, and those who did so knew their names would be published in the local press, jeopardizing their jobs and hence their mortgages. In Alabama, the few blacks who dared to visit the registrar had to fill in a detailed form, read part of the Constitution, and answer questions such as,
"If a person charged with treason denies his guilt, how many persons must testify against him before he can be convicted?
Name the Attorney General of the United States.
If the President does not wish to sign a bill, how many days is he allowed in which to return it to Congress for reconsideration?"
Other blacks suffered physical intimidation, as Fannie Lou Hamer explained.
"Since I went down to register, it's been bloodhounds in front of my door. We being harassed, but I'll be right there fighting for freedom until God say enough done."
In 1965, King took up the cause by targeting Selma, Alabama. Once again, he and dozens of others were locked up. On Sunday, March the 7th, protesters tried to take their case to Alabama's capital, Montgomery, only to find the way barred across the bridge out of Selma. When they refused to turn back, state troopers and a local mounted posse attacked with clubs and tear gas. Amelia Boynton recalled,
"The horses were more humane than the troopers. They stepped over fallen victims. As I moved aside from a trooper's club, I felt a blow on my arm. And as I was gasping for breath, another blow by a trooper knocked me to the ground And there I lay, unconscious.
Bloody Sunday, as it became known, shocked the nation, and also Johnson himself. A few weeks later, he asked the Congress for a Voting Rights Act, which would use the power of the federal government to eliminate all state and local barriers to colorblind democracy, in accordance with what he called the American Promise.
At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. Our mission is at once the oldest and the most basic of this country: to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man. And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. For with a country as with a person, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?
Picking up one of the most famous songs of the civil rights movement, Johnson intoned to prolonged applause, "And We Shall Overcome."
Someday.
It still took months of arm-twisting by Johnson to get the bill through Congress. But on August 6, 1965, he signed into law the Voting Rights Act. Watching him in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol were many specially invited African Americans, including Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was a landmark for several reasons. Now that federal examiners were policing the process, black registration rose rapidly. And once blacks had unlocked the ballot box, they could elect their own representatives to state assemblies and the U.S. Congress, who would then promote the interests of African Americans, just as had happened earlier when European immigrant groups got the vote. Equally significant was the grassroots pressure that brought about the legislation. The Voting Rights Act also mattered constitutionally. Although equal rights had been written into the U.S. Constitution for nearly a century, they were left to the states to enforce. Now, the 1965 Act signaled that states' rights were overridden by individual rights, enforced by the federal government. This too set a precedent for the future, accelerating what became the rights revolution.